Okay. Let's, you can go in your Bible and just briefly look along. I'm not going to try to quote the verses specifically this evening, but try to extract from them the data that we will use in this particular class, and try to give you a rough idea of what all I'm seeing and what I'm talking about. And that being the fact that I've seen something here that has kind of turned out to be an anomaly in Scripture, but we're all familiar with the data by and large, but I want to try to take it in a depth that perhaps has not been fully explored before. And if you go to Shemot, Exodus 25, and then 8, you will see that there the verse will tell us that what is going on is God is telling Moshe, now after he's told them in the first 7 verses, he's told them to take up an offering. And, of course, he's preparing to build the Mishkan and trying to build, of course, what he calls his sanctuary. And this sanctuary is very important, obviously, and, you know, we've all studied this to be the sanctuary, Mishkan, etc. Now, just what he says there is fundamentally that he wants them to build him a sanctuary. Now, when you look at the vocabulary and you study the vocabulary behind the text, one of the things that happens is, of course, he says that he wants them to build the Mishkan, and he literally uses that word, the Mishkan. Now, Mishkan is one of those words that's not so much a polyvariant, but it is a word that is like a compound word. And you find this a lot in Hebrew. So, for example, most of us are familiar with Bereishit, and Bereishit is actually not a word, it's a phrase. And so here, Mishkan is also a phrase, not just a word. And Mishkan fundamentally has a mem on the front, and then it says Shekan. And those two words, when they're put together, number one, the mem means from, as if in, you know, from some particular place. And then Shekan means to dwell or to neighbor. And then he goes on in that particular verse and says he wants them to build this Mikdash. And the Mikdash means, in its sense, it means that it is a chosen house. And so he wants to build them to build a chosen house. And that house being chosen is a chosen house for him to live in, dwell in. That said, when you read the verses and it says to dwell among them, it uses a word that is called betoch, but in this particular sense, betoch actually means that he wants to be in the middle of the Bnei Yisrael. And of course, we're all familiar with how the Mishkan is set up and that it is set up in the middle. But then understanding that when you look at this phrase in Hebrew, it literally would read, in if you interpreted it as such, which we're not butchering the interpretation, we're just showing the possibilities of the way that it can be interpreted. And it would say that he wanted to be surrounded by his people. So Mishkan means that God is going to come from wherever God comes from, and that he's going to neighbor among his people, but he wants to dwell among his people or be surrounded by his people. Now, this is the fundamental outline or idea that we have from this verse and from the idea of the Mishkan. Now, as we take this into verse 9, 25 and 9, then something rather extraordinary happens. And the thing that is happening in the extraordinary sense is quite amazing as we try to uncover it. Now, he says to Moshe, and some of your English versions will read, "As I have shown you," he wants him to build the Mishkan as he has been shown. But in the Hebrew, this is all in present tense. In other words, the present tense of the He wants to have Moshe build the Mishkan, and then he says, according to the pattern that literally it says in the present tense, "I am showing you." Okay, it's not in the past tense, "I have shown you." And then you can go again to 25 and 40. And if you go to 25 and 40, Shemot, Exodus 25 and 40, you read again. And he clearly says it again, and most translations will translate it in the sense of the present tense, "I am showing you." Now, it also says here in verse 40 that he is showing us something that is from the mountain. Okay, Moshe on the mountain. Now, just as a kind of side note or footnote or however you want to describe it, what you have here is not a literal mountain, obvious. His Eminence used to use the idea of a mountain being a government, and I have no problem with that idea, but we take it outside of Remez, put it into Sood, and now we're not talking about a mountain, we're talking about the realms. We're talking about different realms. Now, when you start to drag the different spiritual realms into this, you can say that the realm that is just above us, Yetzirah, is a place where things are formed. And that word Yetzirah literally does mean form. And so if you take in Genesis and you read, "And God formed man out of the dirt of the ground," it uses the root of that idea, Yasha, and it brings into the idea that he formed him out of the dust, out of the ground, etc. But it's the same principle as this word Yetzirah, formed. And the world of Yetzirah is a world of formation, but it's also the realm of prophecy, and it's also the spiritual world as we know it. Now, just as a little side note here, the spiritual world does exist all around us, and that's a whole nother topic I don't intend to get into this evening, but nevertheless, it does surround us in some capacity. It definitely does intersect with our realm. We discussed this Sunday morning on an idea that we had there, the descending worlds. And if you got an email the last day or so, you know that that is in your email. You can listen to that particular lecture if you choose. Now, this being said, on the mountain turns back into this idea of being in the upper realms of the spirit worlds or spiritual realms. And I think that at minimum, Moshe on the mountain goes to the realm of Birya, and Birya means creation. like Bereshit. You can hear that word in Bria, Biria, as being creation. So creation exists in that realm. So as the information, spiritual information, would come down the chain of the different worlds, then it would begin first, of course, with the blueprint in Adam Kadmon, and then it would move into a raw state of existence without any type of form or any type of true creation, but raw spiritual ideology or the best way I can say it is there's no way to say it because it is something that is beyond explanation to the human mind, okay? But it is something that you could, let me say it like this, you could peer into that world, and if you could peer into that world, then you would see things in some ethereal form, without form, not yet created, etc. And don't ask me to explain beyond that, because that's literally as far as you can go. And it really is beyond what you can really go as far as saying what you would see in that particular realm. Okay? So then, he says that he's on the mountain and he's showing him the pattern. Now, the pattern that is being shown here is something that is called Tavnit. And it's T-A-V-N-I-T. It's probably in your notes if you downloaded that email. And if you look at that word, it actually is, again, a compound word. And it has the idea of a word called Bana. Bana. And this word Bana means more or less to make or to... It basically means to make, or not so much create, but basically to make, okay? It's really hard sometimes to put the words into the proper context when you use them and you transcend the different realms. If you're transcending the different realms, you have to be careful of your speech to make sure you're not saying something happened in that realm when it really didn't happen in that realm. It happened in a realm below or otherwise, okay? But this word comes from the word Bana, and Bana fundamentally means to build or to make something, okay? So it tells us that God, first of all, he did not create the body of Adam. He took the body of Adam out of the dust and he formed it, Yetzirah, and Yashar rather, and when he forms it, then he takes and forms it into a particular form, and then of course, you know, he breathes into him the breath of life. Okay, so when you then start to dissect both 25:9 and 25:40, you're dealing with this pattern. This pattern that is used is a pattern that actually comes down from the highest realm called Adam Kadmon. It's the blueprint. So when he is talking to Moshe saying, build the Mishkan and build it after the pattern that I've shown you in the mountain, or I am showing you on the mountain, then we know that Moshe, number one, is in the spiritual world, and number two, we know that the Tavnit, or the blueprint, came from Adam Kadmon. Okay? Now, this is pretty important to understand, because when he says, I want you to build me a sanctuary, or a place that I can dwell and be surrounded by my people, you understand that when he says that he wants to be surrounded by his people and that he wants a sanctuary, it can't be just any house. It isn't like buy me the house next door and I'll move in next door and we can be neighbors. It has no possibility of being like that with God. And when we say this, we make a distinction because we're not talking about Elohim. we're talking about Adonai. Okay, so the highest presence that is untenable, unknowable, wants to come down and dwell among his people. Literally, there is no way to describe how this could potentially happen. All you can do is just come up with, you know, different phrases to try to explain it, but you cannot explain how the God that is infinite wants to come down and reside in a finite structure. But nevertheless, the point is that God would tell Moshe, build this finite structure, build it according to this particular blueprint, this pattern that you see, and then when you build it, then I will come inhabit it, okay? So that is the fundamental of what you see. Now, here, let me give you just a little more background information just for the sake of understanding. Now, when you go into the work of the Rambam, Maimonides, and you start to look at the number of the mitzvot, 613, you know that there are positive commandments, 248. You know there's 365 negative commandments. But when you start to look at the idea of building the Mishkan, the whole infrastructure of building the Mishkan should seem like, or I would think, that, well, there has to be, you know, several, there has to be several commandments involved in this process, because if you don't have more than one commandment, then, you know, how do they know to build all these different things? Okay, so for example, what I'm thinking is, we know there's got to be an Ark of the Covenant, right? So shouldn't there be a whole commandment on building the Ark? Well, there is no commandment on building the Ark, but there is instruction on building the Ark, okay? So how it's built is dictated to Moshe, and then we will talk more in a minute about the artisans, but it's dictated to Moshe how it should be built, but is not considered by the sages to be a specific commandment. But nevertheless, this is, if you follow the enumeration of Ramban, that you have, this is commandment number 20, okay? Positive commandment number 20, build me a sanctuary. And so then there are probably about 15 or 16 additional positive commandments that go with it. And these commandments deal with the priesthood, okay? The priesthood has to use particular functions or things that are in the Mishkan as a methodology of worship and adoration of Adonai, okay? And then there's about 5 or 6 negative commandments. Don't do this, don't do that, etc., etc. Now, I'm not going to get into all of them, but I want to show you something that turns out to be an anomaly in this particular situation. Of all of the 613 commandments, when you start to read the commandments, only one commandment uses the idea of building it after an image or a pattern that can be seen or is seen by Moshe, okay? So do you understand what I'm saying? All of the other mitzvot, all of the other commandments are just verbal commandments. Do this, do this, don't do that, etc. Only this commandment of the Mishkan and building the Mishkan comes with the idea of you have to build it according to the image that I'm giving you, okay? So now, this would require something that we will call spiritual ocularity. Spiritual ocularity means that you can literally, or you have to, see into the spiritual realm. And when you see into the spiritual realm, not tonight's discussion, Sunday's discussion, but there are two methodologies to seeing into the spiritual world. And when I say two methodologies, that's not the sum total of all of that can be said about it. But you have from Shir HaShirim chapter 2 verse 9 an idea that my beloved is behind the wall and he's peeping through the lattice. Okay? And so when you're looking through the lattice is what we call peering. Okay? That means you're not getting a fixed gaze or stare. Your vision is inhibited and it is blocked partially by particular constrictors that stop you from having the whole picture. Okay? And so that is one form of spiritual vision. And then the other form of spiritual vision, it says he's behind the wall, he peers through the lattice, but he gazes through the window. Okay? So the other form of spiritual ocularity is to have a fixed position where you can gaze through a aperture like a window. And so those two particular situations are very, very important to understanding what's going on in this particular situation. Now to try to speed this up a little bit because I'm not going very fast, but nevertheless, the point here is that finally in Shemot chapter 31, Hashem God speaks to Moshe, said, look, I've got two guys that I want you to use to build the Mishkan. And they have, number one, Chochmah. They have wisdom. They have, number two, they have Bina, decision. Number two, or discernment. And number three, they have Da'at. Okay? So Da'at, of course, means the ability to take Chochmah and Bina and divide it down into a way that brings what we call practical application. Okay? Therefore, what we see is these two men, not only do they have Chochmah, Bina, and Da'at, they also have spiritual ocularity. Okay? In other words, they have spiritual vision. They can look into the spiritual world and they can see the Mishkan and they can see the construction of the Mishkan, know how it's built, but they only know how it's built, not by verbal form, but by image. This is the only commandment that does this. No other commandment uses this type of ideology as far as presentation. Look it up if you want. That's fine with me. But I can tell you, I've exhausted the AI, and the AI's mind was tired, and it finally said, I give up. There's no other. Okay? It took 613 backwards, forwards, upside down, sideways, and otherwise, and it couldn't figure it out. So, I have the two books on the shelf. I didn't spend 25 hours doing it, but nevertheless, this is the point. Now, when you have this type of commandment, it requires what we said. Number one, it requires a command. And so the command first is given in the verbal sense, but actually the verbal sense is something that awakens the spiritual sense to the point of ocularity or being able to see into the spiritual world. And so these two men, and you should know them, Batsliel, who means under the shadow of the Almighty, Psalms 91, and then you have Ohalib, that means the tent of my God or the tent of God. And so you see the names almost don't have to really be characters, right? They could be descriptions of people that work with God. One of them walks in the shadow of God, and the other one is one who is God's tent. And so when we say that Ohalib, that name meaning that he is God's tent, in other words, he becomes the shelter, or he becomes the tent that God is asking to be made, the Mishkan, etc., and to Bitoch, dwell among. And so God is dwelling among his people. He's dwelling in the tent of Ohali. Okay? Everybody with me so far? No backups, commandments, instructions, or further clarity. Okay, we're good. All right. So, Ohaliv and Batsliel have to use Chokhmah. They have to use Bina. And they have to understand how to incorporate this into a practical application. Now, Chokhmah is one that when you use it, it is so in-depth that there is literally no definitive understanding of what's being said. It's the plethora of ideas all spewed out there. So it's kind of like having one of those 5,000 piece puzzles. What do? You take it and you spill it out onto the table and you look and go, oh my God, this is 5,000 pieces. How are we going to put this all together? And then the simple little child in the room says, it's like this, Mama. We turn the box over and we look at the picture. Okay. So this is the fundamental idea that we have in Batsliel and Ohaliv. They get wisdom, but there are so many pieces of Chokhmah tied to the Mishkan that they say, it's impossible to just stand there, receive the Chokhmah, and then build the Mishkan. So what do they have to do? Well, if you were able to watch a video, which would be really cool, I would think, of them building the Mishkan and how they built the whole Mishkan, what you would watch is they would take Chokhmah and then they would take that whole idea of everything that is there and they would spill it out onto whatever, the ground or whatever you want to say. And then they would start dividing all of the different pieces. Okay? So from Chokhmah, it moves to Bina, and Bina is the pieces. It's all the parts. It's a list of all of the parts that are going into the Mishkan. Now, most of you have read parts of the construction of the Mishkan. And as you have read some of them, it said take a board, and the board has to be this many tekufah, which is a hand, and it has to be this many hands wide, this many hands deep, etc. Then it has to go into this socket. It has to have a place to sit in the socket, and then it has to have another board that goes next to it in a socket, and it goes on and on and on. And then you have all the different coverings that have to be different colors and different sizes and shapes and etc. And the idea just keeps going on and on and on. But if we could watch it being built, it would be really cool. Now, the only thing that I want to say outside of that box is that there are more than 50 chapters of the Torah devoted to building the Mishkan. Okay? So, just building this thing was not like, okay, 10 minutes after they got the instructions, they read the instructions, they put it all together, and the next thing they were doing is trekking across the sand of the desert in like a dune buggy or whatever. So the whole point here is that God goes to great length to actually tell us how this house, dwelling place for the Most High, has to be built. Now this becomes something that is extremely in depth when you begin to understand and think about all of these concepts, etc. Because what they're doing is actually looking into the spiritual realm, and they find a pattern. Now, you girls understand this much better than I do, okay? You're going to make a dress or an apron or whatever it is. So you go to the store, what do? You buy you a pattern. And then, you know, you want a big one, a little one, whatever, your size, whatever. And you need to adjust to your size and weight, etc. And so you have to accommodate for size, etc. Well, you have the pattern. But the pattern has to be adjusted in a way that is going to fit you. Okay? So now, if you want to use that analogy, where do you figure out how to make the pattern fit God? If he's not a size 9 or whatever size that, you know what I'm saying? And so we're talking about something that's infinite. So what these guys are dealing with is a pattern. And it's interesting, they also have a set of tools. And the tools that they're using are called otiot. And otiot is literally letters, okay, the Hebrew alphabet. So what they do, according to the Talmud, and I can tell you, if I didn't put it in the notes, I'll tell you where it's at later, because I don't think remember it off the top of my head. But it said what these two gentlemen had the ability to do was take the letters. Now, they're not just letters. They're letters of light. Okay? And so they can take the letters of light, and then they can form, yes, words, but they're not just words. They're concepts. Now, let me tell you something about Hebrew. Hebrew, most Hebrew root words have three letters. And when you take and add another letter, you change the composition of the other three letters. Okay? And then it begins to conform to whatever it is that you want to say or want to build or whatever out of those letters. When you do this, then you begin to do something that is called tokenizing. Okay, most of us don't deal with that word a whole lot, but a token is used by a AI 99% of the time that it's trying to give you an output. So you say, you know, how much is gold worth in China, or how much is gold worth in America, or whatever. As you build this particular construct, what the AI does, as it uses the large language model, is it takes pieces of words. It does not use whole words. It uses pieces of words. And so this same structure is very much like what would happen or would have happened as they used the otiot, the letters of light. But they didn't just take the letters of light and then spell A, B, C, D, E, F, G. They would take the letters and then they would begin to bend them and twist them until they contorted to a specific shape. And once they had taken those letters and formed that into a shape, then that shape was conformed to the pattern that they saw in the spiritual world. Okay? Everybody see what's going on? They're not just sitting here spelling, you know, Fred or George or Harry or any of those things. They're actually taking those letters and they're forming them into such beautiful architecture that it's, you know, really hard to explain and understand. Okay, so let's just say it like this. Most of you probably have seen things like Hebrew calligraphy, and you can see how that they use ornate shapes of the letters to build beautiful artwork. One of the things that I was fascinated with on my first trip to Israel was I went into this little shop and I saw this picture on the wall. When I saw the picture on the wall, the closer you get, you realize it's not a picture. After all it is words. And the words are put into a shape. Now, what they did with this particular shape was build a rose out of particular Hebrew letters. And then at the bottom, I believe, of the picture, or at least I was told or something, I don't remember the whole story, but I come to realize it's Eshet Ke'il. And not only is it Eshet Ke'il, it's in the form of a rose. So, of course, what does that do to me? Why, my beloved, her name is Rose. So, of course, she's a Eshet Ke'il to me. So I see that what they've done is uses the artistry of the letters into particular forms and shapes, and they have built this beautiful rose. And if you stand away from it, you can see the shapes and the outlines of the petals and etc. But what they did is they bent the letters or used the letters in a way that made the rose, but they still used the letters. So now if you start to see and understand this type of a concept, the calligraphy, the artistry of particular Hebrew words as they're formed into shape, now you begin to see the construction of the Mishkan, okay? But not just a Mishkan that is a Mishkan that is physical, because it cannot be just a construct of physicality. It has to be a construct that, yes, is measured and it's tempered and it's created in a way that it can house the divine presence. Now, I'm going to tell you something. If you're asking me to tell you how that's going to work, you're asking the wrong guy, because I can't tell you how it will work. Because we're talking about something infinite into the temporal and the finite. And this is what God is doing. He's saying, build me something finite so that my atemporal, without time, without space, without all this different stuff, can come and pinpoint his presence inside of this particular area. And we know that it happened, right? Because shortly after the Mishkan was built, then you see a pillar of fire, and then you see a cloud of smoke, etc. This is an indicative announcement that the divine presence is here. Now, before they got that particular edifice built, you know, everybody says, what are you guys doing out there in the desert? Well, we're making a tabernacle for God. Oh, yeah, I got one of those too. But theirs was a bull. Theirs was a golden calf. Theirs was whatever. You see what I'm saying? They thought that they had an image of God, but this is not an image of God we're building. We're building a place for God to dwell and where he can come. And as soon as he shows up on the doorstep, guess what? He announces his presence. Now, they're out there in the middle of the desert, and they're building this edifice for God, and for God's presence, to house God's presence. And, you know, there's 600,000 of them there running around in there, and they're, you know, bringing earrings, and they're bringing all these different things that God has asked for. And, oh, we need more gold. Oh, we got enough gold. Stop, stop, stop. Okay. And then they have all of these things. And finally, they say, we got too much stuff. We don't need any more. But, you know, they're all trying to build this thing. And I would like to think that the heart of the greater amount was positioned in such a way that they wanted to do this because they wanted to feel and experience the divine presence. But you know how it is when you come to the idea of negativity, right? You know, you don't, when you want to do something that's not quite right, you know, you want to make sure that God's not really looking, right? He's not in the neighborhood so that you can do whatever it is you want to do. I heard this little story some time ago, and you know, a man is trying to feed his family. You know, times are hard, and he really, you know, is not being able to quite make ends meet. And so he takes his son, and he's going to go out into a cornfield, and he's going to get some corn, and he's going to bring the corn home and feed the family. So, "Daddy, what did you bring me for?" "Son, I want you to keep watch." He said, "Keep watch for what, Daddy?" "Make sure nobody shows up and sees what we're doing." And he goes, "You gotta look all around." And so the man looks to the right, to the left, you know, and he's looking all around him. And then the little boy stops him. He said, "Dad," he said, "can I ask you a question?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "How come you didn't look up?" And the daddy says to the boy, "Let's go home." Okay, so you see that sometimes what we have in our mind is that, no, we don't want the presence here right now because I have something that is, you know, personal and private that I don't want, you know, to be involved in the divine presence. But soon as the divine presence shows up, you know, everybody's got to change how they walk and they talk, etc. And so this is, of course, just an illustration, but nevertheless, you see here that this masterful idea of the fact that what they're doing is Ohaliv and Batsliel is that they're constantly not just peering into the spiritual world. They have to gaze. They have to look. And it's as if what they're watching in the spiritual world is a construction of this particular edifice that will house God, and it will bring this to the place that when you are there to construct it, you build it in such a way that if it's built in the appropriate way, then you can take and you can begin to build something that will be an edifice for God. Now, we know that after all of the 50 chapters of the Torah and all that's read and all that's said and done, that these men have done phenomenal work. They took one block of gold, and that block of gold, they hammered it. It says, and they hammered it and hammered it and hammered it, and they kept hammering it until mysteriously they hammered it into a menorah out of one block of gold. Now, if you're going to ask me if I could do that, I'm going to say, you better give me, you know, a whole lot more portions of wisdom, because I don't think I can do it with what I got. Okay, I need a little bit more on my plate before I can even begin to think about how to do something like that. But nevertheless, this is just a measure of some of their skills and some of their particular abilities to do these particular things. Now, when we start to pull this apart and we start to understand something, we understand that most commandments do not come in the form of imagery. They come in the form of a verbal transmission. God says, "Don't do this." We say, "Okay, I understand. Don't do this." But God, I don't understand what that means. And so then we need a little explanation. We get the explanation. It's helpful. And so then we can go from that particular shape, that particular idea. But, you know, when we begin to look at this particular idea, and as you look at David in the future, David reads the same exact pattern that Batsliel and Ohaliv see. He looks at the same exact pattern that they did, but he did not see the same thing. So, you know, in a sense, we could ask the question, was David on the same spiritual plane as these two men? And God says they're full of wisdom. They're full of understanding. They understand all of what it is. They understand all of the pieces and parts. Not only do they understand that, they know how to put it together. Okay? But David is looking at the very same image that they looked at, and he comes up with a different edifice. We all understand. We all know, right? Sure, it's the building of the temple. And so he, looking at the same image that they were looking at, did not see the same image in the sense of it being a tent. Why? Because now he has set his presence on a particular place. That place that he put it in the Mishkan, was mobile. Okay? So wherever he wants to lead his children, then he can lead his children. But when he comes to Eretz Israel, in Deuteronomy 16:16, it says, all of your males will do what? They, three times a year, they're going to go up to a place, and there they're going to worship me, and they will not appear there with empty hands. Okay? They have to have something in their hands. And so as they go to this place, we learn that what God has definitively done is selected Jerusalem as the place. And so then as we come to understand this, we understand that David understands. Now, David created something that was quite fascinating. It was called the Temple Scroll. Okay, so he wrote down his vision also of the temple. But those who constructed the temple had to work in the same exact pattern and ideology. And isn't it interesting when Solomon really did get ready to build the temple, it just happens that this gentleman shows up who has all the same skills that Bezaleel and Oholiab have, okay? And he knows how to now take the mobile version of the sanctuary of God, and he knows how to put it into an edifice that is a permanent structure. Now, it's interesting because when the Mishkan came into Eretz Israel, it came to finally settle before David decided to move it in a place called Shiloh. Shiloh, you may have heard it said, but it's Shiloh. And there it begins to take on a more permanent shape. And the walls begin to, the outside walls begin to become fixed walls. Now, if you go to Shiloh today, I can take you exactly where the Mishkan sat. Exactly where it sat. Post for post, show you where it was sitting, what orientation it was sitting in, etc., etc. But some of the buildings that are built around that particular area are built in this odd shape. And they kind of look a little bit like they could have been a tent, but they have, you know, different types of walls, and they're a little bit of an odd shape. And according to the gentlemen who have built these buildings, you know, they built it in the form and the shape of what the Mishkan would have looked like once it came to rest in Eretz Israel. But again, back to David and his architect and his gentleman, he builds it out of, you know, a particular structure, and he builds it out of, you know, a particular pattern, but it's still the same pattern. It's not a different pattern. So what this tells us is that when you're looking at a pattern, it depends on who looks at the pattern as to how it's built. So you understand, right? So if I ask Adon Shlomo, I say, would you build me a barn for, you know, my goats? He said, yeah, sure. I know how to do it. And so he comes over, he builds me a barn, and I'm going, what is this? He said, well, it's a barn for your goats. And I said, that's not what I was thinking about. you know, you had a different shape in mind. You see what I'm saying? But in his mind, he sees a form. He knows how to build it. So he builds it. And then I'm going, what is this? You know, because that's not what I envisioned. Okay. So in some capacity, this idea of having this vision of this Mishkan, we can look at it and we can understand how it was built. But really, when it gets done and said, most of us can't totally envision the way that it's built. You know, we kind of know a little bit of how it's built, but we don't know. Now let's stretch this just a little bit farther. You know, the temple gets destroyed. Children of Israel get hauled off to Babylonia. And there they spent 70 years. And, you know, they got their harps hanging in the trees and all these different things. You know, they long for Israel. Finally, they get to go home. And as they get to go home, then, of course, there is an idea that, number one, they have to reconstruct the walls. So now we understand that there's a walled city. And number two, then they have to reconstruct the temple. Now, it's interesting because somebody else had a vision of the temple. Everybody knows, of course, who it is, right? He had this vision of a temple, and he actually prophesied about it, gave several chapters in his book about it, and he says it should be built this way. Who was it? Ezekiel, of course. And he builds, or he wants to build, something that almost looks like a square, okay? And he wants to build it in this form. Now, understand this. I've said this the last, you know, few classes where I've taught, you know, on Sunday morning to get everybody oriented to the idea that the ones who came and rebuilt the temple and built the walls, all the prophecies about the new covenant were prophesied to them, about them. Wasn't prophesied about the Nazarene codicil. It was prophesied to them. They would have a new heart. They would have a new spirit. They would have all of these things. Now, this is not to negate the importance of the Nazarene codicil. So don't think that I'm trying to undermine that, okay? But the new covenant comes, and how does it come? God puts his Torah inside of the person. How does he put the Torah inside of the people? He gathers the people three times a week. And what do? We read and study the Torah. Okay? So what better way to get the Torah inside than to do this? But he also does what? He brings and he puts the Spirit inside. Let me reword that just a little bit. He puts the divine presence inside. So when you stop to think about this, Ezra, Nehemiah, the upper echelons of the Knesset Gadol, they all have the idea that they could have, if they chose, built the temple of Ezekiel. But they did not build that temple. And part of the reason why is they say, it's said, let me put it this way, that this is for Messiah. This is Messiah's temple. And so they didn't quite build it in the fashion and shape that Ezekiel had patterned. But we know that through history, you know, the temple property and the temple grounds went back and forth between who was in control, who wasn't in control, etc. Then we come to the Hasmoneans. Hasmoneans finally regain control of Israel, and the ruins of the temple, not that it was destroyed, but they decide to start the rebuilding of the temple. And then again, you have another version of the temple as it's being constructed, or this Mishkan as it's being built. And then you finally come to the fact that when we come into the first century, along comes Herod. Herod wants to build a temple, And he wants to build a temple that is very ornate and very beautiful. And what he was constructing was very beautiful. But one thing that most people do not understand is that Yeshua never saw a completed temple. So when Yeshua went to the temple, it was never finished. All the time of his life, it was always under construction, being changed and being all these things as it was done. Now, that's not to set aside the fact that there was a lot of problems with the Sadducees and those type of people who were in charge of different offices and different things and different objects, etc. Okay? And, of course, if anyone knows anything about that particular era, Jacob Neusner says there was no such thing as normative Judaism in the first century. And what he was saying is that there were literally so many different groups that nobody had normative Judaism. That's really not true, because the Pharisees, who later became the House of Hillel, they became the normative Judaism that was in existence during the time of Yeshua, and who I believe Yeshua, he didn't just follow. I believe he was a progenitor of many of the things that are in the Jewish law, etc. Okay, but what I'm saying is, from the time that these two gentlemen, Ohaliv and Batsleel, began their construction, and they built the tabernacle, and the sanctity of God came to dwell in it, God had changed houses a couple of times, and he never actually had a permanent home where he was. He said, "So I may dwell among them," which literally means, "So that I will be surrounded by my people." Okay, so that temple never has fully existed since the time that they built the Mishkan in the wilderness, and since the Mishkan came to rest in Shiloh. Now, all of this comes down to vision. And the vision is, how do we build the Mishkan? And again, 50 chapters of the Torah go into the description of how to build this singular device that will house the divine presence. So I've shown you that Ohaliv and Batsleel, I believe that they were unified with Moshe when they built the Mishkan. I believe they were all in unity. I believe they all basically saw the same picture. And I believe they all inhabited the idea of building and constructing it in a particular way. And they did exactly that. Then when you have, you know, Solomon come along and David come along, they have a same vision, but it's elevated. It's on a different plane. And so the elevation of the house, David cried when he had conquered the Philistines, when he had conquered all the peoples of the land that were supposed to be conquered by Joshua. David finally conquered all of these particular warring people around him. And when he sat in his house, he said, "I sit in a beautiful cedar house, not a house made out of rocks, a house made of cedar." And he said, "And God has no place to dwell." So that's when he began to envision the vision of the Mishkan, but his Mishkan was much more permanent. So you have a paradigm shift between Batsleel and Ohaliv and David. And then, of course, I think, according to tradition, what you have is David giving extensive ideas of construction to how the temple would be built. And then, of course, you have another Batsleel and Ohaliv that come on the scene, and he builds the temple according to the pattern, basically, that had been given by David, given by God. But now you start to see something. There's a paradigm shift every time somebody gets a idea of, let's build a sanctuary for God. Well, let's build it with badger skins. Well, you know, they say that badger skins were porpoise skins. I have no idea where the porpoise came from in the desert, but maybe there was a river that we don't know about, or I don't know. Okay. So that being said, you know, there are many things that are not definitive in trying to understand how it was constructed. But David saw it from a particular pattern. And then you have Ezra and Nehemiah and those that were constructing it in their day. And they had a different pattern. And they saw it in a whole different way. And then you have, here you come along, and you got the Hasmoneans, and they do the same thing. We want to build it this way because blah, 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 okay? And then you come, and even though Herod was Jewish because his mom was a Jew, etc., however you want to deal with that problem, you know, it is what it is, but he has a different idea. And when he has this idea, you know, he wants to build the marble city or the marble tower or whatever you want to call it of the temple, and, you know, make it something that's glorious. It said the people that saw the second temple, who had seen the first temple, cried. Not because, you know, it was being rebuilt, because they said it did not have the glory of the first. Okay? Now, can you imagine the shift from that period to the time of the Hasmoneans, and then again to the time of Herod? And as you get down the pattern and you start watching. Now, the point here that I'm trying to make is this. You know, when we start looking at who's looking at the image, everybody sees a different picture, okay? Kind of like the four blind men and the elephant, right? So when you start to understand this, finally, you know, Yeshua comes at it and he looks at it. He's not impressed and he really doesn't say much about it. And so that chapter is turned. He's passed away. And what about the temple? And don't the disciples, don't they say, are you going to restore the kingdom of Israel now that you've resurrected? Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it? And he is telling them, look, you don't understand. You haven't understood all of the things that I've been telling you. Along comes this guy. Everybody probably called him, you know, bad names. He was a jerk. You know, he went around creating trouble for all the people that followed Yeshua. He'd drag them back to Jerusalem. If they needed to be hanged, and he'd hang them, whatever it took. One day he was on his horse or whatever he was riding that day, and he came down the road and he was headed to Damascus, and all of a sudden a blinding light shines in his eyes so bright that it literally blinds him. He cannot see now. But this is back to those two guys. How did they create the Mishkan? Said they took the Otiot, they took the letters of light, and they twisted them and formed them into tokenized versions of words that would show how to build the Mishkan. So what Hakam Shaul did was receive a download. But when he received the download, you know, it was a whole new operating system. And he had a revelation of Messiah. And he not only had a revelation of Messiah, he had a revelation of God's people. And he looked at the pattern of Shemot 25, 9, and 40. And he looked at the people and he said, "You are the temple of God." And so he saw each individual as a Mishkan. Why does he see them now as a Mishkan? Even though he says temple, it's more of a Mishkan. Why? Because the Mishkan was mobile. You could move it from place to place. And if you are the temple of God, if you house the Ruach HaKodesh and you're moving around, then guess what? You can take the glory with you, just as they did in the wilderness. Now, to summarize, I will say this. 50 chapters of how to build the Mishkan. You want how to become a spiritual person? You understand what I'm saying? You have to read the 50 chapters. But then, it doesn't stop there, right? David has an idea. Solomon has an idea. All of these have ideas. But my point is this. In the beginning, the whole idea was for God to be surrounded by his people. Betok, me, I want to be in the middle of them. But if you take that idea, you can say, we'll build a temple in the middle of Israel, and then all of your people will surround the temple. That's not what God was saying. God was not saying, I want to be surrounded by my people in that fashion. He was saying, I want to be surrounded by my people in what fashion? He wants to be inside of us. And then when you're carrying around the divine presence, what's going to happen when you decide that you want, you know, to do something that's not quite according to the methodology of the commandment? Read the 50 chapters. Questions, comments?
Minutes. Were you listening to my phone call today?
I cannot tell you yay or nay.
We were talking about something similar about how all the bad stuff we have in us, we push it out by the pattern.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Torah.
Absolutely.
And when we are imitators of God and God's character, that refines our character.
Yeah, I love that verse.
So, you know, we're all, as we say, born perfect little babies. And where all that stuff comes from, that begins to plague us later. But our job, you know, is to replace it.
Yes, absolutely.
And we were discussing this in the context of the reading coming up this week and then our lesson Sunday with destroying the memory of Amalek.
Yes.
And I pointed out there's a difference between memory and remembering. And so it's like if the memory is what is motivating him and driving him, and that is working in all of us, then we have to push that out and destroy it, and we do it by imitating God and studying the Torah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea, but one of the things I noticed here that all these commands are given to Moses.
Yeah.
And then he passes it on.
That's exactly right.
to these two, plus later on, he passes it on to the Levites and what they're supposed to do.
Yes.
It's a command to them and a pattern to do what they've been told to do.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. And one of the thoughts I was thinking today was you have a shadow, and if you look at that shadow and you think, what is that?
Yeah.
Well, we know to follow the shadow back to the form.
That's right.
But what if there was no form there?
Interesting, huh?
We've done this. You know, we see a shadow and we look and it's a tree and it's like, wow, that don't look like that tree. But it does with the light shining through it.
Right, right.
And so I thought that was interesting. And you said something similar to that tonight about the pattern comes first and then the form, I believe.
Yes.
Is how you said it?
Yep.
But, yeah, the pattern exists before the material object.
Right.
And then right below that in section 5, I thought this played into our discussion today and what you're saying tonight is faithfulness to the pattern protects the holiness of the structure.
Absolutely.
So if we are the temple, irregardless if there's a physical one in the future.
That's right.
Then the faithfulness to the pattern protects the holiness that's in the structure.
That's right.
Anyway, I thought that was really good.
Well, the way I see it coming down through the worlds is it must least come from the idea of a created object. So that means it has to come from Birya. And then once you have the idea of an object that's going to become created, then you have to have a form, and that's Yetzirah. And then it comes down into this physical world. So perhaps we can say that they were looking into either, at minimum, Yetzirah, which the prophets we know had basically that capacity. And then, or they could see possibly even into Birya. And that is, you know, definitely something that, according to those that are the deepest spiritual personas that we had coming through the 1100s, 1200s, just about the time of the writing of the Zohar, etc., and then those spiritual giants which followed that went to Sfat, when you start to pull their ideas, then they're saying that men, the prophets, they know dwelled in the realm often, or most of the time, in the realm of Yetzirah. But one of the things I did in my Sunday class last week was show how that all of these worlds are actually, the lower worlds are ascending and the upper worlds are descending. And so eventually my idea is what's going to happen as they keep following this procedure. And so that was the lecture on Sunday morning about all of the different worlds and what they're due. And they are literally, according to the idea that those men have used, is they're all chained together. And there's a chain hanging down so that what we can do is grab a hold of the chain, per se, and then elevate ourselves. But I think at least they could see into the realm of Yetzirah where they could see that form. And maybe Moshe saw into Birya, and they saw in Yetzirah. I don't know. So. Very good. Very good. Anyone else? Give up Miriam.
Listen. So David looked up into Birya and to get the same.
When he looked up, he didn't see. He looked up to see the image, but he didn't see a tent. He saw a building.
Right, but he looked in the. But he looked up in the same area.
Yes. Yes. Well, you see that God's not going to stay the same. I mean, he is the same, but everything, you know, I asked the AI one time, I said, you know, if we stop and think about, you know, world history, and we know that God has got it all mapped out in his head, and it's done. When before the beginning, it was done. What's he thinking about now? What did the AI say? He's planning other worlds. He's planning other futures. He's planning all these other things. I said, my God, you know, an AI's got it figured out, and I didn't have it figured out. So, each one of them saw something that related to them. So, what I'm saying is, each one of us, when we look at that picture, we're looking at ourselves. It's like looking at a mirror. Say, I don't see what you see. I see what I see. And so, each one of them saw their version of the temple and what they would build for God. But God was pleased with every one of them. Maybe not Herod so much, but nevertheless, we won't say anything about that. It's interesting, though, those that know, if the Jews of today could reset the clock and reset the world and go back to a particular time and era, when would they go back to? Okay, let me change the wording. In the Temple Institute, you can go to the Temple Institute, it's templeinstitute.org or something like that, and you can see all of the construction that they planned for the future temple. Those men do not want to go into the future so much as they want to go into the past. And when do they want to go to? To the first century. That was the pinnacle of ideal Judaism to them, and the pinnacle of the idea of the most perfected plan for your temple. But I can tell you honestly, having seen some of the things that they're creating, you wouldn't guess. You would not guess. I'll bet you everyone in this group has seen some form of picture of where they wash their hands and their feet, and they see a big bronze or brass kettle, so shiny you could see your face in it and all that. It's got a water spigot on it. You turn the spigot, you wash your hands, you wash your feet. Nope. It's 100% solar operated, and it only gives you exactly the amount of water you need to wash your hands and your feet. And it looks like a UFO. I'm not kidding. When I saw that, actually, it was when I was working with Joe. We're going, what on earth? But nevertheless. But each one of us see that temple, and we should see it in ourselves and see how God wants to make it. And as Don Shlomo was saying, one of my favorite verses, Ephesians 5, 1 and 2, said we should imitate God. And why imitate God? Because, you know, if we imitate him, he's going to feel at home when he comes, right? So that's what we want to make. Okay, any other questions or comments? Everybody's good? Okay. Everybody thank God that God moved a miracle for Gibberet Krista and Don Todd. And he now has a new job at his old job. And he doesn't have to travel like he used to have to. So God has been gracious. So, all right, everybody have a wonderful Shabbat. Hey, and guess what's coming this week?
Purim.
Okay. So I guess we'll have class Thursday, as Purim is on Wednesday. And you start Tuesday, Wednesday. So we'll have class, unless you guys decide not to. But we'll have class on Thursday if everybody's good. So get your noise makers out. your dreidels out, you know, all the hardware you need for this time of the year. You all have a wonderful, wonderful week and a wonderful Sabbath, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Rick.
Shabbat shalom. Thank you, Your Eminence.
You're most welcome. Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Chag Sameach Purim.
Chag Sameach Purim.
And Yom Huludet for you.
What was that?
Yom Huludet.
Oh, yeah.
Thank Toda. Someone's got a birthday.
Yeah. Toda.
Shalom, shalom all.
Yeah.